Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie, as always, with John. What's up?
Dude, how you doing?
Good. I try to think of new ways to open and lead into you talking, but I feel like I do the same thing every week.
And I'm just over here trying not to talk about how beautiful it is outside and that it's 70-something degrees.
No weather, but it is incredible. I walked over here today.
I got a tree I need to cut down, and I'm like, man, it's perfect outside for some tree cutting.
It is good for some tree cutting, and it's a good day for a crime story. In case you missed it, last night we dropped an exclusive interview with, hopefully, future exoneree Jamie Snow about where his case stands and what he needs to get some testing done for a new trial, and there's a lot of things that you can do to help. So if you haven't listened to that, go check it out.
Absolutely. It's infuriating and heartbreaking all at the same time. So please, let's be the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. Check that out for sure and take some action if you feel fit.
Today's case is a good one as well, although this one does seem to be, I don't know, have a pretty clear outcome once we get to it.
There's still part of a mystery.
There's still intrigue for sure.
Well, before we take off on this one, I do want to say thank you to BJ. BJ joined us over on Patreon and came in at the $3 a month level. And that's awesome. If we really just want as many people to join as we can, we drop brand new bonus episodes only available to Patreon members. And we've got some good ones over there. When you join, you get instant access to everything we've ever done, nearly 8 years worth. And you get our regular episodes early and ad free. You get your own feed. So it's a great way to get us a little early and without ads.
Yeah, and obviously to support us and keep the lights on, and we really, really appreciate that.
We got to buy a new computer soon. So
we do.
Patreon members, if you could help with that, that would be amazing.
This is clunky. If anybody has one for sale, I'm just kidding. Yeah. We really appreciate you guys.
Also want to say thank you to another Patreon member. Just a huge shout out for Liz. Came in with a huge just a huge blessing financially for us. So Liz, God bless you. Thank you so much. The world needs more people like our Patreon members, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. She re-upped for another year. Super excited about that. So we got a lot of good stuff coming up.
Liz, I sent you a DM over on Patreon. You can tell us what case you want, or if you want something else, just we'll give you whatever you want. Just let us know.
Yeah. That doesn't sound creepy at all.
Yeah. I regretted that as soon as it left my mouth.
Okay. But
I said, Liz, I sent you a direct message. There you go. Jamie, why don't you please help me out by getting the ball rolling?
Yeah, let's start talking about some crime here. Thomas J. Capano was the kind of guy who seemed to have it all. He came from a prominent family in Delaware. They were real estate developers, lots of money. They were building contractors. Really at the lead of the real estate game in Delaware, which is, in this area, was fairly affluent. He graduated from Archmere Academy in Delaware and went on to become a rich, successful, well-known attorney. During his career, he was a state prosecutor, Wilmington city attorney, legal counsel to the governor, and a popular political consultant. On top of that, he was a part of his family's home construction business. So he is successful in multiple business areas. He is not only successful financially, but he's a counsel to the governor. He's a consultant. He is looked at as somebody who's an expert in the legal field. He was married with four daughters when he took the position of partner at Saul Ewing LLP.
That's like two of the things that everyone wants in life is money and power. You know? Right. So if you've got the ear of the governor and you own businesses, you're going to be doing okay. It was the early 1990s. His marriage, however, was falling apart because he was less than a stellar husband. So in 1993, 43-year-old Capano met 27-year-old Anne Marie Fahey, an unmarried aide to Congressman Carper, in his D.C. office. So when Carper was elected as Delaware governor, Anne became his scheduling secretary. In her diary, Anne wrote by her birthday in 1994 that she was head over heels in love with Capano. They had a 3-year romantic relationship, and during that time, Capano slowly separated from his wife and was still carrying on multiple affairs with several other women. When it came to Anne, though, Capano showed her, like, just enormous amounts of love. He showered her with attention, with gifts, expensive meals. Out of all of his affairs and his wife, it seemed like she was the one that got his most devotion, even though just this guy's a dirtbag.
Yeah, never a fan of adultery, just in general. But this guy's having multiple affairs. And you mentioned he was not a good husband. I mean, that's absolutely true, just on the basis of he wasn't faithful. And everybody kind of knew it. He was successful in a business suit, but kind of a sleazebag in his personal life with sleeping around. As time went on, Anne started to see how controlling and jealous that he was. Even though she was not his wife, they were not official, although he did seem to favor her to his other mistresses, she started to see that it wasn't really a healthy relationship for her, and she wanted to end it. But when she tried to, the powerful, rich lawyer and business mogul wouldn't allow it. Now, I know that's a weird sentence to say that he wouldn't let her in the relationship, but as many cases we've covered with all kinds of stories about grooming, about power dynamics and relationships, he was a powerful guy in every aspect of his life, and he tried to exert that in his personal life as well. So he was essentially telling her that she had no choice but to stay with him. So she started dating another man, a guy named Michael Scanlon, but she didn't tell Capano. Now, John, is there a responsibility if you're having a secret affair with somebody to tell them you're having a secret affair with somebody else when you know they are already?
Thankfully, I don't know, like, the terms and conditions of affairs.
Well, that's why I'm coming to you, bro.
But, I mean, all of this is bad anyway, but yeah, you know, if you're going to cheat on each other, you should only cheat on each other with each other.
Yeah, it's got to be your bull.
But I don't know. This is all just awful.
But she didn't tell Capano she was dating Scanlon. On the evening of June 27th, 1996, Anne and Thomas Capano went out to dinner in Philadelphia. This was a common move by Capano, taking his mistresses out of town to avoid prying eyes in their small town, to avoid people just running back and telling his wife, even though I think she probably knew something was going on. According to their server that evening, this dinner was not a happy one. And I think it's, I don't know, I've never been a server, but I think it's probably clear to see what's going on with the dynamics by the way people interact.
Yeah.
Their body language says a lot.
You're kind of the third wheel, so to speak, of a pretty intimate setting, but you're viewed by the couple as like a non-player, like an NPC, non-player yeah. character or whatever. Yeah. So they probably overhear some stuff that they would want to be kept secret.
According to that server, Capano ordered his food without even asking Anne what she wanted. The two drank wine and picked at their food, but he said they both just looked absolutely miserable. And at this restaurant in Philadelphia, this was the last time anybody saw Anne Fahey.
2 days later, her family still had not heard from her. She actually missed a date with her new boyfriend, Michael. So they visited her apartment, and feeling something was off, they went to the police. So when police got there, they searched that apartment, and they found letters that Capano had wrote to Anne, along with her diary. In her diary, Anne detailed the just horrible relationship that she was having, and that she had been trying for months to break things off with Capano. In one entry, she called Capano a controlling, manipulative, insecure, jealous maniac. That's not a good
a good
description of somebody, you know?
It sounds like an accurate one from what we know.
They also talked to Anne's friends and her family, who confirmed that Capano was definitely overbearing and Anne wanted out of the relationship. Investigators quickly zeroed in on Capano as their prime suspect and Ann's disappearance. And when they talked to Capano, he was adamant that he invited Ann to dinner that evening, that the evening went well, and he escorted her home, or her home, and then they separated or parted on good terms that night. So he seems to directly contradict what the people in the restaurant had said, and definitely goes against what her diary said. You know, he said they parted that night on good terms. I don't think Anne was feeling it, though.
Yeah, and at any point that somebody goes missing or is hurt, the first place they always look is the significant other and the last person to see them before they go missing. And in this case, Capano was both. Now, she did have another boyfriend, and I'm sure they looked at him as well. But so far, Capano is the first guy you have to clear before you really move on, while you're following other leads, of course. But he is the chief suspect at this point. So they started looking extensively at other sources to reveal what happened that night and what was going on in their relationship. They looked into toll records, so toll roads of when they may have gone through those, emails from Capano's law firm, surveillance, analysis of gun purchase records, search warrants, psychological profiling, and financial records. We end up saying negative things about law enforcement sometimes. They went all out here, and they threw the kitchen sink at this investigation, and I absolutely love that. 1 month after Ann's disappearance, the team found a strange purchase made by Capano at Wallpaper Warehouse 2 days before his date with Ann and the last day that she was seen. Federal prosecutor Colm F. Connolly said, "I knew enough about Capano at that point because we're a week or so into the investigation. I know that he is not the kind of guy who does home improvement himself. I know he's living in a rental house, so he wouldn't be buying wallpaper. I thought it was all very weird."
That would be like me buying a lot of fitness equipment on my credit card. They would know something was up.
It just doesn't add up, right? So they called the number on the financial records, and when they did, the person answered and said, "Airbase carpet." Connolly immediately assumed that Capano bought a carpet and rolled Ann's body up in it. They used this information to get a search warrant for Capano's rental house. And, I mean, obviously they're going to go out and see what's going on there. Is buying carpet enough for a search warrant, though? I mean, I know I have let my hand show that I do not like Thomas Capano so far in this story. Is the carpet it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because the guy owns part of a company that's like a contracting company. So in my mind, you know, if these are on his personal card, it makes you wonder, like, is he doing a big home project? So I don't know. I personally don't know that would be enough if I were a judge to do the search, but maybe there's more that we just don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously he's the last person to be known to be with her and all that additional information. But to jump from he bought carpet to he rolled up her body in it just seems,
yeah,
it seems like a lot.
It is interesting, though, because I think back on a case that happened in the county we live in where a female went missing and they found a receipt that showed that her body, well, they found a receipt for a rug and they found that they had rolled her body up in a rug and then bought that exact rug to put back in its spot. So that's kind of what's in the back of my mind,
right?
Is that case.
Yeah, I get that.
So Connolly arrived at Capano's home and Capano actually answered the door in his bathrobe and he looked shocked to see the investigator at his home. Do you own a bathrobe? Just a little ADHD moment.
No, I mean, they have them in a hotel room, so sometimes I'll wear those.
Do you?
Yeah.
All right. I've never had one. Maybe I'm old enough to get one now. Inside his home, investigators ended up searching for 11 hours, and they found tiny spots of blood right next to his new rug. So that's kind of you find this receipt, if you will, and now there's a new rug, and you've kind of like, bam, I got you now, right? They later used blood plasma donations that were made by Ann to verify that those drops in his apartment or his rental home did belong to Ann. They additionally dug up his backyard, but they didn't find anything when they did that. When they received a tip to find more evidence at Capano Construction dumpsters, investigators followed up and discovered the dumpsters had been taken to the Wilmington area dump. And they spent days digging through the dump and ended up finding nothing there as well. But they did find her blood, and the fact that he bought a new new rug does kind of make you wonder what was going on there, right?
Right. I think the implication there is that there was something that happened where that rug was, and she bled there. Perhaps that's where something happened with her, or he laid her there and then put her in that rug and then didn't clean up well enough when he replaced it. So that's what they're thinking here. I find it pretty fascinating that they tried to follow the dumpster full of garbage to the dump, and also that they couldn't find it. It seems like if it was that recent, and it was pretty recent, you'd have a pretty good shot of it. But I don't go to a lot of dumps looking for stuff, so I could be wrong. I know they're huge.
It would be awful to search, but I would, is it safe to assume they had some cadaver dogs so that would make the search a little easier?
Yeah, and I don't know that they had that. I also imagine a cadaver dog would go nuts in a dump because of so many foul odors that would be really tough for them. But they're trained to power through. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about the rest of the investigation and all the evidence they gathered against Thomas Capano. Already kind of given props to law enforcement for at least a good initial approach to this. They are going all out to find things, digging up his yard, which I have to imagine that there was something in the backyard, like some disturbed dirt or something, to make them think that should happen. If you go and look at my backyard right now, nobody's dug there for a while, right? So I would think they would know that there's no reason to.
Right.
But they did here. So law enforcement's doing all this, but then they agree to hand it over to the FBI because the FBI has more resources than they do. So that tracks, that makes perfect sense. The FBI put together an investigative team with Wilmington Police, the ATF, and the IRS. Now, the IRS brought down Capone. I guess this could be part of it. This wider team uncovered a 10-page letter written by Capano detailing facts about his relationship with Ann. This letter also laid out a timeline of what he had been doing that day, and he said that at the time of Ann's disappearance, he was with his younger brother, Jerry. So authorities went to Jerry's home, where they found illegal drugs and guns. I mean, if my brother is accused of something, and it leads authorities to my house to bust me for stuff, I guess I shouldn't have had illegal stuff. But still, that's I would call that an unintended consequence of his brother using him as an alibi. So now Jerry's in custody, and soon their younger brother, Lewis, was also brought in. In November of 1997, the brother started cooperating with the investigation to avoid federal charges. So they were helping with this investigation to figure out if their brother, Thomas, did something to Ann.
Well, they admitted that they helped to get rid of evidence, and the whole story they told was gruesome. So here's kind of a timeline of what they ended up saying. So they claim that their brother Tom murdered Ann and put her body in a large fishing cooler. And the next day, Tom used the cooler to bring Ann's body to Jerry's boat. The boat was called Summer Wind. The boat was docked in Stone Harbor, New Jersey. So according to the brothers, they loaded up the boat. They drove out 60 to 75 miles from shore. And then Tom threw the cooler overboard, but it wouldn't sink. So Tom grabbed a gun that was kept on board for shark fishing, and he shot the cooler, but it still would not sink. So then Tom had to take the cooler back onto the boat, and he decided to take Ann's body out of the boat, out of the cooler, attach weights to it, basically like an anchor. And Jerry says that's where he gave his brother an anchor and a chain, and he turned his back as Tom threw up and then put Ann's body into the water. Jerry did say that he turned around just in time to see her foot sticking up out of the water, but then sinking as the anchor carried her below the surface. So they also said that Tom then took the cooler, threw it into the water, and then they all drove back to shore afterwards. This is a
brutal story.
This is so brutal. So brutal.
What a horrible way to, I mean, obviously the murder is the bad part, right? But to be this disrespectful with anybody's remains. And I love my brother, but I don't know if I love my brother. Let's get rid of a body enough.
I don't love anybody enough for that.
Point taken.
Probably people are glad that I don't like have sole ownership of our justice system, but I feel like even if Tom was the sole person that killed her, if you're willing to help him by disposing of her body, whatever punishment he gets, you should also get. You are, in my mind, just as culpable.
Yeah, well, at this point, I think they are cooperating, so they were given some leeway to be able to say these things without being held accountable for them. So they were essentially ratting on their brother to get out of this, and they need, I guess the prosecution needs their testimony, so that's why they didn't receive as much of a punishment. But I totally see what you're saying. FBI agents got wind that Capano was going to try to leave the country, so they moved in and arrested him on November 12th, 1997, even though they had no body, no cause of death, and no murder weapon. Now, you don't have to have those things to prosecute somebody, but they certainly make it a lot easier. This was a pretty highly publicized crime, and the trial was going to be a media circus because that's what happens when a prominent family gets brought into a crime case like this, or I guess inserts themselves into it. The trial began on October 26th, 1998, and for 12 weeks, both sides presented their cases. The prosecution had both of his brothers as witnesses and relied heavily on their confessions. They pointed out that when Jerry's boat was sold, two anchors were missing, which corroborates his story saying that they tied those anchors to Ann. Jerry testified that his brother Tom said that he needed the boat because he admitted that he had murdered someone who was attempting to extort him. Considering a lot of his shady dealings, I mean, people may have been trying to extort him. He also said his brother asked him to get rid of the bloodstained sofa and carpet into a dumpster that was managed by one of their companies, specifically one owned by their brother Lewis. Tom told Lewis to empty the dumpsters earlier than scheduled, but still, the authorities got track of that and tried to track them down and couldn't find them, but they were desperately trying to find that furniture and the rug.
This next part's pretty wild considering how vast the ocean is. But in a big win for the prosecution, there was a local fisherman who found the abandoned cooler floating in the Atlantic Ocean about a week after the brothers attempted to sink it. The fisherman kept it in a shed. He ended up turning it over to the prosecutors after seeing the case in the local newspaper. The prosecution brought the cooler in to show the jury, and Judge Lee later said that it was astonishing that the cooler had even been discovered. I mean, you talk about a needle in a haystack. Just how wild is that, that someone found it and drug it aboard and kept it in a shed and then saw the article? How wild is that?
That's insane. The fact that he found it is insane enough, but to be able to map it back, I mean, it's just, the odds have to be astronomical.
The judge went on to say on the record, quote, "It's certainly stranger than fiction, the truth. My reaction was Tom Capano should know there really is a God now," end quote. I don't know where the later part of that sentence, like where the context is from that, but obviously this judge knows just how powerful that evidence is and that Tom should know, hey, God is seeking justice on behalf of Ann. So that cooler becomes really important later. But in the meantime, the defense presented a very different story altogether. And this is wild. The defense began a bold claim saying that Capano did dump Ann's body at sea, but he did not kill her. So check this. Earlier in the trial, another one of Capano's girlfriends, Debbie McIntyre, testified that approximately 6 weeks before Ann was murdered, Capano told her to go buy a gun and to give it to him. And she said that she did what he asked. But now, according to Capano's defense, Debbie was the one who killed Ann with the gun that she had personally bought. The defense said that Debbie found Capano and Ann together, and she went hysterical, and she was threatening to kill herself with the gun she had bought. Capano allegedly tried to stop her, and during the struggle, the gun went off by accident and ended up killing Ann. Capano said that he disposed of Ann's body as a means to protect Debbie. Is there any truth in this story outside of the fact that Debbie bought a gun for Capano? I don't know. I personally don't think so.
It seems like kind of a Hail Mary here to say, well, they found her blood in his rental house, and his brothers are saying they helped him dump the body, so we can't get away from those things, but how do we take the gun out of his hand?
Isn't it wild? Like, this guy is the biggest dirtbag, and if this story is made up, the fact that you would bring in another person to try to throw this off on is the one of the biggest, outside of killing Ann, the biggest dirtbag thing you could do.
Yeah, and they didn't find the gun, so there's no way to track that back. But, I mean, you can look at some forensics of, well, I guess they didn't have the body, did they? Like, how could you prove or disprove whether or not this happened? At this point, you can't test Debbie's hands for gunshot residue. You can't try to map out things and see what happened in the home because it's all been cleaned up. So there's no way for them to prove this, but there's also no way for the prosecution to disprove it. So I think this comes down to, who do you believe? And this jury, who had been sequestered, deliberated for 3 full days. And at one point, they got really morbid in their discussions. Aaron Riley Lee was a 28-year-old juror, and she said, honestly, a lot of people would be surprised to know that when we first went in to deliberate, first thing we did was take a poll to see where everybody stood, and it was half and half. And she was one of the not guilty votes to start out. At one point, the jury suggested they needed to see if Ann really could fit into the cooler. So there's the morbid part. Aaron was the same age and about the same size as Ann, so she felt every juror look her way when they came up with this idea. Now, jurors are not supposed to do their own experiments like this. This is frowned upon heavily for them to do their own tests because they're not experts in these things. But they wanted to try this out. One of the other jurors told Aaron that she didn't have to, but Aaron agreed to climb into a 3-foot, 8-inch cooler. As the jurors helped her in, Aaron had to squish herself inside to fit. They tried to close it, and it wasn't a perfect fit, but it was a lot closer than, I mean, I guess you're hoping to disprove, like, there's no way this could happen or it could happen, and I think they decided that it could. Capano had testified that he laid her on her side and pushed her knees into the fetal position, but that he broke no bones in the process. Aaron knew it couldn't have happened that way because she had been bent up in that same position. There was no way that Ann could fit in that cooler on her side without breaking any bones or worse. This was enough to sway most of the not guilty voters. After this ordeal, Aaron went back to the hotel room and cried while speaking out loud to Ann. And she said, I'm just so sorry. I'm so sorry that this happened to you.
This is one of the most odd jury deliberations I've ever encountered. That they, I don't know, is it normal for them to have access to evidence?
I assumed this was a different cooler of the same size, but you're right, it may have been the same. I don't know. If they pulled it out of the ocean and a body had been in there, then I don't know that I'm going to.
Yeah. Maybe they just found one that was the same one, like, yeah, and bought it. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. Not a strategy that you can use to determine guilt.
Yeah, they're not supposed to do this because they're not qualified to perform the experiments and check everything out. And I've seen cases get thrown into mistrials because of this. But also, it seems like everybody agreed on the cooler part of the story, right? Like, the brothers testified they went out with them, and Tom admitted that he was out there with them disposing of the body. So how is this even relevant to guilt or not?
Yeah, that's what I was saying, is I don't know that you can't determine guilt based on this. On January 17th, 1999, he was convicted of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death by lethal injection. So, interestingly, this was the first time in Delaware state history where a person was convicted of murder, but when there was no body or murder weapon that was discovered. Sorry, I'm going back to old cases, but we covered a case in Tennessee where a man was convicted of murder when the woman's body was not found. So just interesting correlation there.
I would say that's more common now than ever. It's gotten more and more common as time has gone on.
In January of 2006, the Delaware Supreme Court affirmed Capano's conviction, but they did change the sentence from the death penalty to life without the possibility of parole. And this was the decision because this sentence was imposed by a non-unanimous jury verdict. In 2008, his first his final appeals were exhausted. By this point, Capano was overweight. He had a long white beard. He was not the picture-perfect image that he had once been. At this time in his life, he was spending 23 hours a day in his cell. And that's you're not seeing the light of day at all. So,
yeah, and that's not healthy for anybody, and it's fairly torturous.
Yeah, he was overweight, just not in good shape, and he was found dead in his cell on September 19th, 2011. He was 61 years old and was said to have died of sudden cardiac arrest. Following his death, his brothers fought in court over the family's multi-million dollar business, which probably no surprises there.
Right. It seems like what they typically did. And they, due to testifying against their brother, did not get in trouble for helping, or not in enough trouble, as far as I'm concerned. Ann's family decided as a group to talk to media while their loved one was still missing. They thought it was the best way to keep the case in the public eye until they found out what really happened. After the trial was over, the family agreed to stop talking to the media or bringing any attention to themselves. They had received a verdict and as much justice as they were going to get for their girl, even though they wanted to bring her home and to bury her and to be able to say goodbye. She was a 30-year-old woman in search of a way out of her troubled, toxic relationship. One of the final entries in her diary said, "For one whole year, I allowed someone to take control of every decision in my life." She was eager to move forward with Michael Scanlon, who was, by all accounts, a great man, closer to her own age, and they got along very well, and he treated her respectfully. Here we are, almost 30 years later, and Ann's body has still not been found. So despite not having a grave site, her friends and family do have a few places where they can go to mourn the loss of Ann. One is a memorial bench that was put up in 2006 that sits in Wilmington, Delaware's Brandywine Park. The inscription reads, "In our hearts forever." So John, we have a story here where all signs point to one man, and his brothers say that they helped him dispose of the body. His counterclaim is that, yeah, we did that, but I didn't kill her. First, what do you think really happened? And then, is justice served here?
Earlier, I said that if the brothers did help dispose of Ann's body, then they should be held accountable for that. So they were charged with crimes of, helping to conceal a murder and disposing a body, but they didn't serve any time. Because they cooperated with the prosecution, they were given probation instead of jail time. I hate this so much. I really do feel in my heart that they should spend the rest of their lives in jail too. So the fact that they didn't spend any time in jail and only got probation for something so heinous, they did not get justice. Or, she did not get justice from them for what they did to her.
I completely agree. Just from that ordeal, again, which everybody agrees that this part happened. This is not up for debate, that they did take her out into the ocean in a cooler and end up tying anchors to her body. This is horrible and gruesome and graphic, and they deserved a ton of time. I don't know what they were offered and if there was negotiation here. The prosecution must have desperately needed their testimony in order for them to offer this sentence in exchange for it. And I mean, if this was their only option, let me ask you this. If it's either we get only probation or we don't testify, as the prosecutor, what do you do there?
I feel like, you know, their testimony did majorly impact the ruling, but I feel like a really good prosecutor could have still got this case done based on the physical evidence in his apartment. And, you know, you found her blood in his apartment. You found the rug. You found that, you know, there's at least contradiction from the restaurant waiter that they seemed miserable, whereas he said they parted in great terms. I think that you have probably enough, but probably enough isn't enough when you're talking about you have one shot to make this case and it's a make it or break it.
Yeah, I don't think they do without the testimony. I think they have the blood. I think if they don't have their testimony, he never admits to disposing of the body. So he essentially, all you have is her blood beside a new carpet and them having an argument at a restaurant. Yes, her diary said that he was controlling and all those things. I don't know that that gets me beyond a reasonable doubt. So I don't know that the brothers gave this ultimatum. For all I know, the prosecutor could have went to them with this deal, but I think they definitely deserved lots and lots of prison time, and I'm very frustrated that didn't happen. Thankfully, the rest of Tom Capano's life was spent behind bars, and that's as much justice as you can get for his role. But
you earlier asked me, like, do I think what actually happened? You know, because there was this story where Tom murdered her and the brothers helped, but then Tom's defense made up the story of his other affair, Debbie, getting involved, and then they hit her body because of that. I think that's all complete bullcrap. And if there was some kind of perjury or something that you could charge him with on top of murder, I wish they would have done that. If that wasn't true and he tried to throw this woman under the bus, I mean, good Lord.
Yeah.
Charge him with lying to the courts for that.
Yeah, I think that if you think about it, anybody who's found guilty of murder and said they were not guilty is essentially lying to the court unless they're wrongfully convicted.
Yeah, if you plead not guilty and then are found guilty, you should get charged with perjury.
I think if it's murder, it doesn't matter that much. I wonder about that in lesser cases, though, because murder, you're getting punished for murder, so a perjury charge would just be a slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
But what if it's abuse of some kind? What if it's a robbery?
You're asking
that's
me some
questions.
That's
a rabbit hole. I'm sorry.
We are dealing with some stuff locally that has just totally screwed up my thoughts on death penalty and swift justice. So I probably should refrain.
I know. I know. It's a bad place to be in asking these questions. So I'll forego that. I don't think she got justice. I think the brothers who got probation and then debated over a multi-million-dollar inheritance, their life is so hard. They should have been punished. So I'm very frustrated by that. I do think that
I feel like if I helped you get rid of a body, you and I are both in jail for the rest of our lives because I don't have the kind of money that they do.
Right. Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right. You don't have the kind of leverage and you talked about earlier, money and power. It's what the Capanos had.
Money talks.
It does. I do think he killed her. I think it was him and him alone, and he got his brothers to help him dispose of the body. I don't think Debbie was involved. I don't know that she should be charged for purchasing the gun. I assume he did that to keep it off his record. If she didn't do it, he would have got it somewhere else, and I'm sure he didn't say, so I can shoot Ann. So I don't think she should have been in trouble for that. But otherwise, I don't think Debbie was involved at all.
Yeah. All right, man. That's going to do it, guys. We appreciate you all sticking around. This was an intense story, and I'd love to know what you think. These always pop up on Facebook and other social media platforms. So leave us your opinion. Did we get it right? Did we get it wrong? What do you think? Let us hear from you.
Yep. We always ask each other if justice is served. Now we're asking you. Let us know in the comments.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.